Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will at least try to be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The World's Wackiest News, a chance to look at all of the news that is completely unfit to print. Joining me are my good friends and fellow aficionados of the asinine, Manny Barling and Ashley Brooks. Good afternoon to both of you.
Good afternoon, Simon.
Good afternoon, Simon.
Manny, is there any truth in the rumor? You know, it's been floated around the internet that you and Ashley actually wear a disguise when appearing on this program so that your friends will not recognize you.
That's why we're known as the food police. We hide and we sneak around and we stir it up.
Just want to get the facts out there, Simon.
Nothing
facts,
but
ma'am.
The facts.
Right. Thank you.
No facts,
just
facts.
The facts.
This program is not really known for its serious side, but today I would like to start with a serious story. We don't often have musical interludes, but today I think we should start with one. Did I just play that?
Well, sadly, John Barry, the composer of that, as well as 11 other James Bond films, died at the age of 77 yesterday. I doubt that there's a person in the world, including in the communist countries, that have not heard the James Bond theme. But he was known for other things. He was known for the themes and score from The Lion in Winter, Out of Africa, Dances with Wolves, and a wide variety of other films, but those he won Oscars for. And he was truly one of the nicest, gentlest men you would ever want to meet. Ashley and I had the pleasure of having dinner with him at a Hollywood event a couple of times, along with Leslie Bricus, who did Windmills of Your Mind and a wide variety of other Oscar films.
And his good friend Roger Moore.
With Roger Moore, of course. And to make a long story short, we're going to dedicate the show today to him for his contributions to music. More importantly, his contributions to all of our enjoyment of the action genre film, because when he did Dr. No in 1962, no film had been scored like this. No theme had been used like this, except for maybe Ghost, what's his name, Leonard Bernstein's version of what was the seminal the movie Man with a Golden Arm, and that was probably the first time that it had that kind of dominant introductory theme. But no suspense film and no other film other than perhaps The Third Man had such a dominating theme. And to a wonderful man and to his family, we miss him. We admit him. We offer the show a dedication. I'm sorry. I liked him very much, and if I sound a little poorly saying it, it's because I have fond memories of a really fine man.
My favorite of it, though, Manny, was Born Free. I guess that's kind of a girl thing, but he made movies. He made the movie. He took a simple scene that would be just you and I taking a video of a scene, and he would turn that visual into something magnificent through the feeling of his music. I mean, he was really something.
Yeah, Simon, do you have any recollections and feelings about his music?
Just the iconic themes that he created through his movies. Sadly missed man. I mean, a composer that I don't think was recognized for his achievements while he was alive. It is so sad that he is no longer among us. And with that, this is supposed to be a humor show.
Well, good. Let me start with something humorous before you introduce our guest.
I want to know why the fur is flying in West Hollywood.
Well, that's a good question. It's because West Hollywood has decided to be a fur-free zone. Well, anyone who knows where West Hollywood knows that there's really not a time of the year. I mean, what you need for the worst weather there is in the 50s, and if it drops into the 40s, everybody goes crazy. So what difference does that make for them to have fur? But yet they're holding press conferences, and, you know, you'd think this was a gay marriage issue.
They're picketing. There's, like, full picket signs on how dare you wear your leather and fur,
yeah.
You know?
Ash and I know a few people that are on the radical side of the pay to interest, and one of them, you know, constantly says to Ashley, oh, this fur is horrible, et cetera, et cetera. And Ashley always says to her, you ever live in Chicago? And Ashley, tell us what it would like to be in Chicago without fur.
20 below wind chill factor, if you did not have a fur coat on, you would freeze to death. And that would be with long johns, a couple layers of clothes, and that was the only thing, because the animal could survive out in that cold. So you're wearing that animal skin to help you survive in that cold weather. And I keep saying that. I mean, I don't know how people in Alaska would live without fur. I really don't. And I'm not a pro-fur person. Go out and, you know, kill your cat and dog. Let's make a coat. I'm about, you know, if it's a necessity as part of your life, then yes, wear that coat. So I just think that anybody who has never lived, you just could not have lived in New York or near any water or up in Alaska or Canada and survive without a fur coat. And the argument with that person you're talking about, Manny, would always say to me, well, you just put on this cloth coat and that's what it's for. The nylon will protect you. I would have froze to death many times in Chicago.
and of course, Simon, you lived in Alberta for a while. So could you imagine being in Canada, in northern Canada, without a fur coat?
Or somebody banning it?
I mean, Canada would not exist without fur coats. I mean, the founding fathers were without doubt the Hudson's Bay Trading Company.
Right.
There
Right. And they traded in fur. Now they trade in Chinese products primarily.
Right.
Although, but to ban it, you know how, in this little area they're talking about, it's just like a little strip. You've been in West Hollywood, haven't you, Simon?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
And it's not a large area, so they're talking about if you're driving from this block to that block and you happen to have a fur on, well, I guess they could be arrested. I mean, it's like so absurd. I guess it's like the Venice milk situation.
Yeah.
The question is, who is it that is pushing this fur-free zone?
has to be somebody who's, who was raised in a hot climate.
Well, you know, it's a very small city with a city council with not much to do, so they look around for issues. And the truth is, if you didn't go to a restaurant in West Hollywood, primarily the Sunset Strip, which is legendary, you wouldn't go there at all. Because there's really nothing there that interests anybody who lives in Los Angeles. Most of us consider it a traffic hazard to even get near the city because traffic is so bad on the Sunset Strip. And recently they actually closed it down, repaved it, and did all sorts of work trying to make it look better because it was starting to look like a depressed area. So if it weren't for this reputation dating back to the 30s and 40s, I don't think it would exist at all, and I'm sure anyone listening in West Hollywood, you know, would be upset with me. But I was born and raised in Los Angeles and spent a lot of time in West Hollywood with friends of mine who are in the sheriff's department who patrol that area, and I've seen it at its best, and I've seen it at its worst. And, you know, for them to start railing about fur is just a waste of everybody's time. And for the news to cover it, which is one reason we cover it, is why would the news want to cover this kind of story? What interest does the world have in what West Hollywood feels about fur? So,
and they want to ban it to the point where you will be an outlaw in your, in that little tiny town. You will be an outlaw if you drive or walk through that town with a touch of fur.
Yeah. So if you drive through West Hollywood with fur, they'll be playing the theme from The Good, Bad, and the Ugly in the background.
That's true, Manny.
I can't wait for the first citation to be issued.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you couldn't wait for the first blog attacking us for saying this.
Not at all. Okay.
It's time to introduce your guest.
Right. Let's move on to our next story. It is an unusual one. Insofar as generally I prefer to report on the strange behavior of other people rather than my own strange behavior. But, you know, but on occasion, I do find myself directly involved. The world of international trade is, without doubt, a heady place to tread. A world of high finance and red tape, which brings up the great import-export scandal involving Mongolia. To help in unraveling this tale of international intrigue, I'm delighted to welcome my good friend and fellow conspirator, Mark Skies, to the program. Mark, thank you for taking time out to talk with us today.
My pleasure, Simon.
Is it okay if we just call you Mongolian Mark?
Yeah, I think that works, although I'm in San Diego, but recently returned from a visit to the continent.
Okay. I do have a question for you, and it's one that I've wanted to ask you for several years. You were a merchant seaman. How does a merchant seaman end up in Mongolia? It is, after all, a landlocked country.
Oh, dear, I was afraid I'd get this one. Well, actually, Mongolia has 42 ships under the sailing under the flag of Mongolia. But that's not how I ended up there. No, I was on a ship that was based on the island of Saipan in the Southwest Pacific, and met a Mongolian woman who was working on the island. We got married, had a son. My time on the ship ended, and I really couldn't sail on it anymore. So I said, well, let's go visit your family and it'd be a good place for you to stay while we get your visa requirements completed so you can go to the U.S. And the boy is still a U.S. citizen, but that is the long and the short of it. So I ended up living there for a year and a half.
You found a problem in Mongolia, the inability to purchase your favorite American delicacy. Tell us a little bit about Spam.
Well, actually, it's my wife's favorite, but that pretty much makes it my favorite, too. Yeah, going in the grocery store, they had a good selection of canned meats, mostly corned beef, that sort of stuff. The writing was in Cyrillic, which made it a little interesting. And, of course, canned mutton, canned horse, but no Spam. And as we've been in Saipan, which is fairly popular and readily available, I was a little surprised, and that's why I contacted our friend Bruce Bateman and eventually yourself to see if we get around this problem.
Manny and Ashley, you've studied food addictions. Do you think that Spam might qualify as an addictive food?
No, I think Spam's a good thing to eat when you want to lose weight, because once you eat it, you don't want to eat again.
Ever again. It's like you lose your taste for everything if you eat it.
You know, Mark, there's no accounting for taste, and having traveled a fair amount myself, I'm always amazed at the things that people enjoy in other countries. But I must tell you, it's the first time I've ever heard anybody root for Spam.
Yeah, and I have to read the label. I need to see the label to tell you how many addictive chemicals are in it, but, you know, we'll get into that part later, I guess.
Wait a second.
I still want to go back on a moment. Did you say they had canned horse? Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah. Yep, canned horse meat.
Wow. I'd love
Although
to see that label.
A little better fresh, actually, but, yeah, they do have it in the can.
You actually had some?
Oh, yeah. Matter of fact, when I was visiting over New Year's, the only argument my wife and I had over the feeding of the boy was whether it would be better for him to have a slice of Spam with his breakfast or some of the horse rib sausage that we had left over from a party at her dad's house.
The horse sausage sounds excellent.
So did they actually raise horses to feed people over there?
It's kind of a side business. Their horse racing is one of the three big sports they have, wrestling, archery, and horse racing. And I guess too many horses, you end up eating a few. It probably goes back to the Mongolian herder tradition, and even the Mongols. You know, they would take dogs and extra horses with them for food if they got stuck in an area without them.
Oh, I thought it was because the horse lost the race.
I don't know.
We're also thinking about that.
In America, they just send them to the glue factory.
Yeah, the Mongolians are practical, if nothing else. They have a fur ban wouldn't fly over there at all. And they actually make a liquor. The horse is almost revered in society. I mean, they make a pretty good liquor out of mare's milk. But eating a horse doesn't turn any heads.
No, and I don't think it should. I imagine they prepare it better than what they would do here.
And I was also thinking about how they had too many horses, I think, up in Canada, and had to thin the herd out. And there was a big problem because people were very, very upset for obvious reasons with it. Because I guess if you're forced to thin out your herd and kill the animal, then at least you're utilizing the animal rather than just killing it for killing purpose. So I guess that's good.
You know, Mark, if I had known you were going to say this, I would have made certain the lady friend of ours who's so actively involved in these animal groups listened to the show to make sure she was sufficiently appalled.
And called in.
You couldn't have stopped her from
calling in. No, no. No.
Can you imagine going into a restaurant, or better still, you know, a fast food chain, and give me a horse burger hold the main.
Anyway, I heard about Mark's plight, and I decided to help ease his pain. I went out and bought a can of Spam, and I mailed it to him. Weeks later, after many miles of being transported by yak and countless nights spent in a yurt, the package arrived. Mark, were you excited?
Oh, quite. My wife ended up opening it.
Actually, as I recall, You sent me a number of photographs. You paraded the can around town and took some pictures of it at well-known areas.
Yeah, well, that only, as many pictures as I could take in a day and a half, and at that point, the spam was eaten.
But so you carried it around to the various tourist places, is that what you're saying?
No, he took his spam for a walk.
Oh, okay.
There was a picture of it on a couple of statues, as I recall.
Yeah, Joseph Stalin meets spam. That was a beauty. 12-foot bronze statue of Stalin.
You have to share those photographs so that they go out on the net. I think that's worthy, don't you, Simon?
Oh, I do. I mean, I enjoyed them greatly. I mean, it was clear that Mark just loved this can of spam.
All I want for Christmas is my can of spam.
Oh, and
now,
you can't get it.
You know, I'm surprised
even more.
Fox News didn't pick up this story. I mean, after all, you know, a can of spam and Joe Stalin, that has to be an article for him.
It would look good on the travel magazine.
Maybe we should contact the Mongolian, Travel Association and see if they're interested in a licensing deal.
You know, and for all those people in America that are in the younger generation that really think spam has something to do with emails, they're learning the truth right now.
That's a good point, Manny. And this is so off the grid for us to talk about spam since we are 100% organic.
Oh, dear.
Can of spam is really interesting.
I'm pretty certain that it's not going to be long before we see all natural spam.
You're probably with a lot of soy lecithin and food additives and flavorings. And does it? Tell me something. Does the spam taste the same as it always did, or has the flavor changed over the years?
Well, I'd have to ask my dad. I mean, my spam and my family.
You know what? That would be
a
real. I would love to know that.
Well, I will inquire, and I'll put a comment on the blogger's news and a link to the blog I was keeping when I was in Mongolia for the pictures.
Oh, fantastic. That's great.
Yeah, we'll have an update.
That.
You know, my oldest brother served in the South Pacific in World War II, and if he saw a can of spam, he actually started to gag. He had eaten so much spam during World War II, it was just repulsive. He said to me that sometimes they were sitting on, I don't want to go into the specific islands, and they had nothing to eat but spam, and they would look at each other and argue about whether they would rather starve to death. And that's how the soldiers felt. But you have to understand that they've been eating it for a year or two on these islands and didn't have any other choices. So spam for breakfast, lunch, and dinner sounds something like that sheriff in Phoenix does to inmates in the local prison, because I don't know if you've heard that story, Mark, but he feeds them SOS, commonly known as shit on a shingle, every day for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's so bad that some of them actually sued the state trying to get it changed to consider it a cruel and unusual punishment.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with green-colored bologna.
Simon, you said something before about canned mutton. Was that one of the choices, too, the canned
right.
mutton?
I'm just about to get to that aspect. Mark was so happy with his can of spam, he wanted to return the gift, shall we say. And the idea was he was going to send me something that was truly Mongolian, and that is canned stewed mutton. Alas, the project didn't really pan out. Mark, you tried to send it, but it was turned back at the Mongolian border, I believe.
No, actually, it made it as far as the States, and then it was returned. Yeah, the FDA has laws on importing meats from other countries that don't process the meat. I think it goes back to the mad cow disease in England a few years ago.
So even if it's canned?
Have a problem with it, too.
Even if it's
It doesn't matter. Actually, I think they do have some incidences of it, but, still have the plague. But they just don't take a chance, and unless it's processed in the U.S., you can't import meats. And
now,
I think there have been some waivers granted, but not too many.
Now, as I recall, we did go for a bit of a plan B. We tried to sneak it through Saipan, but that didn't work either.
Our couriers ate it, is what happened there.
Well, only in America, you know.
That's very funny.
What's life when you can't trust your courier, you know?
Actually, the really unfortunate part about this entire story is I had spent quite some time researching, you know, stewed mutton in cans, and I found some great recipes. You know, Jan was quaking in her boots at the concept that a can of this stuff was going to arrive in the mailbox.
Tell Jan I'm with her.
I'm totally with her.
Although eating in some fast food places might be below eating Spam.
I agree. Or mutton.
I think so.
Or a horse.
At least the horse doesn't have weird additives.
Actually, the whole import-export world is a strange one. Mark, I know that you recently returned from a trip to Mongolia, and you had just a little bit of a problem at LAX with some cigarette lighters. Yeah, do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a sad story. But we actually tried to buy a can of Spam in a local grocery store the day I left UB, or Ulan Bator. But they were out for, I don't know why. They had horse, but I didn't think that was what I wanted to bring with me. As it turned out, though, it's probably better that I didn't have it in my baggage because they were looking for someone smuggling reptiles, and my flight stopped in Beijing. So we got the whole treatment from customs, and I'm not very good at declaring every little thing I have as long as I'm under the limit. Well, I had a couple kind of joke cigarette lighters. Mongolia, the apartment building, it's generally old Russian-style apartment buildings, long, dark hallways, and Mongolia is still a pretty poor country, and any light bulb in the hallway is immediately taken away and put into someone's apartment. So you generally have a lighter with a little LED light on the bottom of it. And which is handy when you're going, because the sun doesn't come up in there in the winter until almost 9 o'clock in the morning. So they're pretty useful. But I thought I'd bring one home, and I saw one that was almost 6 inches long. So I stuck a couple in my checked baggage, and the customs inspector in L.A. was a little perturbed that I hadn't declared everything. When he saw the lighters, he was, oh, you can't have a lighter on an airplane. I said, well, I'm not on an airplane, am I, anymore? They let it go in Mongolia, and now I'm here, and I'm not getting on any more planes, so... That was that, and he let me go, although he was quite disgusted with me.
Yeah, I guess they found somebody that was coming in with importing turtles, and they were just, you know, putting them in their pockets and any place that they could hide the turtles, and that's, you know, you caught the tail end of that one because people have been bringing things into the country they really shouldn't be.
Well,
they certainly weren't Mongolian reptiles. I don't think anything would live at 20 below up there.
Well,
I mean, I was there. The high was 5 degrees below.
5 degrees below?
Yeah.
Wow. Good Lord, that's even worse than Mississippi.
Not the faint of heart, huh?
Were you touring? Is that what you were doing there?
I was visiting my wife and her family.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, the other problem was they arrested somebody in Texas who had just literally hundreds of uncared-for snakes, and they traced it down to one of the Chinese countries, so they got vigilant and for probably the first time in years made some serious effort to check what was coming into our country. I mean, you know, right now, what goes on in our airports is a sporadic knee-jerk response to whatever the latest problem is, and they just don't really put enough effort into doing it all the time.
In the meantime, we can't get mutton into the U.S., although I'm going to tag along with the Haggis getting a waiver to come into the country, and maybe they'll let stewed mutton come along with it.
Oh, haggis is nasty.
Okay, you have to explain haggis to me.
Haggis is a
You take a sheep's intestine, you stuff it with ground sheep bits, and some rice and some oats, and you boil it. I mean, what could be more natural? But no.
I don't know if there's enough spices in the world, and I would have to I'd have to wear a clothespin on my nose and be blindfolded in order to eat that.
Well, I think I can top that.
I'm sorry, what?
The Mongolians have a specialty which is a cooked marmot. Marmot is sort of like a big prairie dog.
Right.
And they take the marmot, remove the insides, burn the hair off, and then stuff the marmot with hot rots to cook it. The only problem is the marmot populations are often infected with the Black Plague, and I actually had a hunting trip planned with my father-in-law, and we couldn't go because the plague was in. The Black Death, that plague.
Yeah. You know, marmot's a popular food for wildcats, tigers, jaguars, and all sorts of other felines. They just love it. And they're supposedly, according to what I've read, they're impervious to the Black Plague. They have some resistant thing in them. But, that has been a problem throughout.
I think this is probably the perfect segue into our next story, which also concerns mystery meats. What is in that paper wrapper when you make the run for the border? Manny, what is going on with Taco Hell?
Oh, you want to get into Taco Hell? We were skipping some of the candy ones. Well, there's been a whole flurry of information about a lawsuit filed against Taco Bell in California by a woman who's in a class action alleging that basically Taco Bell doesn't contain entirely meat, that it's only 30% meat, 35% actually, and 15% of it is protein. So they're saying, what's the other 65%? In all fairness to Taco Bell, the president says, you know, basically it's 88% of beef, and the other 12% is our special flavoring. And without our special flavoring, it wouldn't taste like a taco. Well, you know, understand, our listeners need to understand that we live in Southern California, and if you want Mexican food, this is the place. And Mark lives in San Diego, which has equal, and some days I've had better Mexican food in San Diego than I've had even home in Los Angeles. So we still don't know what Taco Bell is. When I was a kid, the franchise, I believe, started either in San Diego or Los Angeles, and the first time I ate there, I said, what is this stuff? And we tried to figure out what it was, because it said Mexican food, but none of us had ever had Mexican food that tasted that bad. So, you know, and I tell this story where they had a very popular Mexican-American restaurant in our neighborhood, and the hostess, a Latina, charming lady, was married to an Irishman. His parents were from Ireland. They had immigrated to some place, I believe it was in Illinois, and she would go visit the family. So one year the family kept saying, no, we have a new Mexican restaurant in town. Wait till you taste it. The food is fabulous. When you get here, we're just dying to take you there. So they get there, and the first thing they do is they drag her to the Mexican restaurant. It was Taco Bell. She was like, oh, my God, they think this is Mexican food. She was so grossed out. The next year she told me she shipped all this food back there to make sure that they had a real Mexican meal. She was just shocked that people ate that, thought it was Mexican food. Now, coming from two people who've lived in San Diego, you want to tell us how you feel about the comparison of Taco Bell to real food?
Yeah, no, it's got to be really, really late at night, and no, it's just nothing I really want to go to.
How about you, Clement? Do you eat Taco Bell's Mexican food after living in San Diego?
No, but I'm kind of with Mark on this one. I think I'd go for the stewed mutton or horse anytime.
Yeah. Well, you know, in my college days, I had a girlfriend who, when she had too much to drink coming from a fraternity party or whatever, she wanted to have Super Tacos when they first came out. And she just could not do without Super Tacos. So at 2 a.m., whatever weird time it was, I'd pull in and get these two Super Tacos to go, and she would eat them. And I would sit there and look at her on the way home going, is she crazy? And then when she sobered up, she'd go, I eat Super Tacos? I can't believe I eat Super Tacos. And she wouldn't admit it.
Simon, wasn't there some story you had about going to wanting some steak and you ended up with some taco or something?
Hey, a story about Kansas City.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
I went on this prolonged road journey. I should be in the Guinness Book of Records. I drove from San Diego to Detroit, and it only took me slightly over 2 weeks.
Would you stop at every McDonald's?
Well, something close to that. I stopped at every place where I knew someone. And one of my stops was Kansas City, and I was really looking forward to this. I mean, Kansas City barbecue. Mm-mm-mm. I arrive on a Friday afternoon, and the people I was meeting were actually a software house, you know, computer geeks. And we had this really nice chat, and they said, hey, why don't you spend the night in Kansas City? You know, one of the guys said, hey, I got a spare bedroom, and, you know, stay with me, and hell, let's take Simon out for some real Kansas City food. I'm going, oh, yum, yum, yum. Well, what do? They take me to a Mexican restaurant. I love Mexican food, but I'm a firm believer that salsa should not come out of a bottle.
A squeeze bottle?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and I'm the guest, so, you know, I'm going, oh, this is great. Yeah, behind the scenes, I'm going, oh, God. Let me out of here.
Did you do your please help me from the fly?
Actually, earlier today, I was thinking about this entire Taco Bell fiasco, and I was wondering, you know, how the Taco Bell spokesman might react. And there's a couple of quotes I could see coming out of Taco Bell in the not too distant future. You know, I could see them announcing that that they're going to come up with the zero beef taco. The spokesman is going to point out that, you know, their tacos are stuffed to the brim and there's just no room for any extra ingredients like beef. Yeah. So that's going to be removed. And maybe he'll he'll continue with something along the lines of, market surveys show a trend amongst consumers away from red meat consumption. Our non-beef, beef taco, will be at the forefront of cutting-edge food technology.
But it's okay, Simon, as long as it comes out of a lab. That's what they'll tell you. Because they can purify it and control the ingredients.
Right.
Anyone here soil and green?
That's exactly where we're headed. All we know is Soylent Green might taste better.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, better still, you can cut out all of that icky, cattle problem raised in CAFO situations.
Oh, yeah. You know, there's nothing quite like having a toxic cow or beef to eat. And by the way, the horse, to me, sounds much more enjoyable than having beef from a factory farm. You know, and to go a step farther with this, let's add to some of the other ones. I just brought up something Ash and I want to remind the general public of. You know, if you talk about the beef in Taco Bell, let's talk about that 12-year-old McDonald's hamburger that still looks fresh. If you look it up on and type in McDonald's fresh 12-year-old burger, you'll come up with a website, and it says and shows you photos about a Happy Meal that still looks appetizing after 143 days on the shelf. They show a 12-year-old hamburger that looks relatively similar to a new one. They have one burger that traveled around the country in a woman's purse for more than 4 years, and the chemicals and everything preserved it. They show photos of it, and they keep updating the photos. And my favorite is, according to Salon.com, it's not just the preservatives. It's the entire ingredients that, quote, give it the shelf life of the undead. You know? So if you don't think that's good, you can always check out Alice Wessendorf's September 2010 posting on the 4-year-old McDonald's cheeseburger, and you can see videos and films of that, too. So now my question becomes, how long will a taco last? And Ashley said to me earlier, should we buy one and just put it away and shoot it? And I said, you know, I don't have 5 years to spare at a taco.
And I think I may do that, though. I think I'm going to buy a Taco Bell. I may do that tomorrow, Simon, and put it away like I did the Nutrisystem cheese that lasted for 5 years and never bent. I'm sorry I didn't take photographs. Never bent, never changed color, was identical to the day I bought it. And then my question became this today with Manny. I said, you know, I think we could save a lot of money when people die if the people who continue to eat all this fast food and preservatives, because they're going to die quickly because of this food, they don't really need to be embalmed.
Yeah.
So think of the savings, I guess, in the end.
So Ashley made a joke with me that, what if we found somebody who eat nothing but fast food and burgers, buried him for 50 years and pulled them up? Would he still be as preserved like the McDonald's hamburger? That's a good question. So maybe we can give him embalming fluid
for
fast food. Look, Simon, how much money you could save on your funeral if you ate fast foods and were embalmed while you were alive so you didn't have to pay for it when you died.
Mark, I want to ask you, do you think this is the way to go?
I'm thinking society is heading that way, yeah. I actually have a
McDonald's
Happy Meal on the shelf in my my bedroom. I'm sort of aging it to see what it's going to look like at the end of 6 months.
I just don't believe
everything I see.
So, Mark, this aged burger, excuse me, beef, maybe people should open up a Craigslist business of aged McDonald's.
I wonder how much that 12-year-old hamburger would actually sell for. I bet McDonald's would pay a fortune for it. They could put it on for $1 million.
They'd pay for it just to get it off the internet.
Yeah, exactly. They'd pay $1 million just to get it right. Exactly. No one will ever see that thing again.
Well, you know, for our listeners, let's add something so they understand what we're talking about. The seasoned ground beef in a Taco Bell taco has 25 ingredients. The list is horrendous when you look at it. You take even the taco shell, that has 30 ingredients. At least 16 contain a form of MSG, and 10 ingredients are from genetically modified plants. A simple tortilla that all of us buy fresh in Los Angeles Corn tortillas are made from corn maize or cornmeal and water, and flour from obviously flour and water. But the tortillas there have 40 plus ingredients, more than 20 of which have MSG, and 12 ingredients are come from genetically modified corn and other things. So when you look at those, they throw a little salsa on. I mean, the salsa has an incredible amount of ingredients. I believe that, well, for example, the chalupa shell has 70 ingredients. Chipotle sauce has 29 ingredients, okay? Enchilada rice has 50 ingredients. So if you order a simple meal like that, you get something that has 120-plus ingredients, and God only knows how many other chemicals. So that's one of the reasons why we talk about it. But you compare it to a Big Mac only really has 69 ingredients, and fries have 46. So Taco Bell has more chemical ingredients than even a Big Mac. So if a Big Mac can last 4 to 12 years, how long will a taco last, right?
This one really got me too, Manny. A reduced-fat sour cream from Taco Bell, which you're going to put on everything, had 18 ingredients, which doesn't include the natural and artificial flavor, which could have up to 200 ingredients. Because it's patented, they don't have to tell you what that is. So a simple thing of sour cream.
Actually, my favorite has to be the rice.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
You know, I mean, normal convention is when listing ingredients, you start with the most first, right? And you go down.
Well, that's actually required by law, Simon.
Right.
That's required by
the
MPA law.
Right. And you go down in decreasing amounts. Rice actually scores rather badly in the list.
I mean, I really think everybody should go to their site and look at the ingredients while they can, because with the lawsuit, you know, who knows, they may pull off their ingredients because they may get embarrassed into actually serving food.
No, actually, the press of Taco Bell went on record saying they were proud of the ingredients, and these ingredients would make this wonderful taste of their tacos. And what they're really not saying to the general public is they use genetically modified products, fruits and vegetables and corn, which we describe at length in our books, and basically they're tasteless. They're just horrible. So at the end of the day, there's no taste in the food that they manufacture, so they don't really have much choice. They have to use these genetically modified products to add some flavor to what they're cooking.
And many of which, as we talk on the Saturday show about how it's MSG, so it tricks the brain into thinking it's good. But it's just awful.
we haven't even got into the addictive qualities that we cite in our book, you know, It's Not Your Fault. So, yeah, they're happy about using it because they want to get you addicted to their food so you will just keep coming back for more.
Mark, I have to ask you, you know, are you a Taco Bell fan?
Oh, no, I have a Del Taco that's right at the end of my street, so my late-night cravings are within a block of the house. I don't even know where there is a Taco Bell, tell you the
well,
truth.
Now, you're talking about in Mongolia now or here?
Oh, here. No, Mongolia, you kind of got to make it yourself. There aren't a lot of... Well, there are street food options. They're big. They have a steam dumpling that's pretty close to the Chinese pot sticker, except it's filled with meat, and we don't ask what kind of meat. And then a fried dumpling, about the same thing.
You know what? It doesn't surprise me. You're eating Spam, so of course you wouldn't want to know what kind of meat it is.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Know,
my
when
dad
you
in English,
about
I gave
Taco
up asking
Bell.
What's in this a long time ago.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I just don't. I grew up with an English father, and I long ago learned not to ask what's in this. Ignorance is bliss in my case.
My sympathies having an English father. I still trying to survive mine, and he's been dead for close to 30 some years, and I still feel the pain of having a British parent. And Simon,
well, I'm fearless when it comes to eating. I just don't ask.
That's definitely a new rule for don't ask, don't tell.
Mark, let me guess. One of your favorite TV shows has to be that one on the Discovery Channel, I think it is. You know, Strange Foods or Weird Foods.
Oh, Yeah, I saw it on the TV last weekend. I've still been in Diners and Dives and Man vs. Food. That guy.
Oh, yeah. Man vs. Food is a trippy show.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
but I travel a lot at work, so I've actually eaten at a bunch of these restaurants. I'm like, oh, wow, I ate there. Yeah, that was good. Like, when am I going back?
Oh, yeah. One of my favorites was the two burger places in, I guess it was Milwaukee, or no, it was in Minnesota. Minneapolis St. Paul had been vying for I don't know how many years for the best hamburger, and they served the most outrageous burgers. They wrapped the meat around the cheddar cheese and cooked it, and it blew up like a balloon. So when you took a bite in it, the hot cheddar cheese spurted out at you. So they interviewed all the patrons there, none of which were less than 40 to 50 pounds overweight, about this burger, and most of them said they were just willing to die for it. And looking at it, it looked like they were all going to die because of it.
So true.
But let's add one more to the food list. And I'm looking for right now, Ashley called to my attention some candy recalls that we just had to talk about. I mean, it is hard for me to believe that they are serving toxic waste as candy. So, Ashley, tell us about this toxic waste nuclear sludge bars, whatever they are.
It's a tongue-in-cheek brand, and they're a visual company that's very proud to introduce this thing. They claim they have all this integrity. It's really a great, great product. And, of course, the FDA regulation is 0.1 parts per million on lead, and it had 0.31 parts per million and had to get yanked off the shelf. So sludge nuclear candy is like no longer available. And of course they had it in various things called, they also had toxic waste, which I don't know if that's been pulled off. I mean, why would you name it this? It was a drum oozing green sludge and chewing gum under this short circuit and high voltage name company.
Yeah.
And it's coming out of China, so it just got yanked.
Yeah, it's a shame. You know, I was actually thinking about a Chernobyl, you know, crunch bar, something, you know, like that would be good.
But what was also scary was at Halloween, I guess there was a recall on Raisinets and a couple other things, and a lot of recalls right now with that, with some of the problems with the candy, and it's actually making me not even look at the candy. Well, of course, the organic candies, I'm having trouble looking at this candy anyway. But the worst one was the gummy bears, because that was one of my weaknesses until I realized it's coming from Malaysia, China, and I don't know where else, but they're making it there, and I no longer have a weakness because it's also full of lead. So I guess if I want to make my body into a bullet, I'll eat lots of candy.
Well, you know, we did.
I love gummy bears. Are you telling me that, you know, a couple of bags of gummy bears is the reason I gain weight?
Honey, tell them about the gummy bear.
Oh, not even that. It's the fact that it's got, you know, it's imported from Malaysia. It's being recalled for lead. And this has been since 2010. Let's see, the press release was the Gummy Bears UCAN Food Trading Company. They distributed it. They did this whole thing. It has too much lead in it. So, again, if you want to make your body into a bullet, I guess, you know, we can use you as ammunition over in the war right now, Simon, if you keep eating that stuff.
I mean, where's life gone to when you can't trust a gummy bear anymore?
Right. I'm shocked.
I know. I bet there's a lot of recalls happening
safe.
Because of it. I'm sorry, what did you say, Mark?
No, I always thought gummy bears would be safe. I mean, what can you do with gummy bear?
I know. And Raisinets. Yeah. How can you screw up a Raisinet? And knowing that they, you know, there they are for Halloween treats. You know, forget it.
They contain
25,000 bags.
Well, you know, Mark, I told a story. I guess we did the candy show Halloween time. And Ash and I put on our food police outfits, and sometimes we feel like we are in a trench coat wandering around these stores, or else we're from another planet. And we're looking at some of the various candies for sale, and I think it was Baby Ruth, and I forget the other brand that they manufacture. I looked at one, and the contents were just basically corn syrup, everything except, you know, chocolate and real candy. And at the end of it, I said, well, maybe I'll pick up the other brand, and I can't think of it right now. same manufacturer, and I picked up the label, and I looked at it, and I said, wait a minute, I picked up the same one. And then I looked at it again and realized, no. Basically, what they had done is use the same ingredients in the other candy bar, but changed its description of it a little bit and had a different name. So all of a sudden, this Baby Ruth tasted just like some other candy, and a famous candy at that, and I found that all these candies are essentially the same.
You got to read, Manny, this is unbelievable. This one with the Nestle's Raisinets, they had undeclared peanuts. Wait a minute, it's a Raisinette, so why would it have peanuts in it? And then the 90,000 bags of Mega Pops had traces of foreign particles believed to be tiny amounts of stainless steel.
Oh, wow.
That's a phone call to the production line.
It's probably so they could wash it without it staining.
Stainless steel lollipops for your kid for Halloween. That was like, oh my God.
And it may just have been a preservative.
Yeah. No, they put lead in it as a preservative.
Yeah, but the stainless steel was, you know, foreign particles containing stainless steel in my lollipops.
Yeah. You know, and this goes back to, Mark, the theme of our books is you can't trust what the ingredients that you find in foods in the store right now. And when you look at them and you take a look at what we've written in the book, they're pretty scary. And every time I think that, well, maybe we've been too hyperbole or something, I read one of these and I realize that, no, it's even worse than we first wrote about, because every time I see one of these, I want to go back and change some parts of the book to include some of this. Because right now, the problem with surviving the 21st century, which is the title of our show, is surviving the foods being sold to you.
I was talking with an agricultural researcher in Mongolia one afternoon I ran into on the street, and he had just come from Beijing. This is just prior to the Olympics. And he said they had tested some of the chicken for sale in the markets, and they said if the customers had eaten, or the athletes had eaten it, they probably would have had a false positive on their steroid test.
Oh, my
gosh. I don't get that either. Well, that Dinah Taurasi is probably the best female basketball player in the world right now, tested positive playing in the Turkey League for some steroid she never heard of, or actually was a banned chemical she never heard of, and is still insisting that it had to be something in the foods there because she doesn't even know what this stuff is. And that's becoming a big problem around the world is when you see the list, for example, O.J. Mayo, a basketball player, was suspended because of an energy drink he took in a gas. He bought in a gas station and drank, and it had a banned substance in it. So this whole thing is just
which is unmarked,
crazy.
And they don't mark it, right, Manny? So yeah. I mean, so they have no way of knowing, or they give it a screwy name that's not really what it is, which is that should be illegal, but it's not.
So that's the main problem with all of that and the candies. And yeah, I want to come back to something for the part of our segment for those people who like to get high, who watch the show, and high means everything from sugar to banned substances. Ashley, tell us about the new craze involving bath salts. And this is for those dudes out there who want to get high.
Well, it actually fits in with what we were talking about. With the synthetic stimulants are legal in most of the United States for now. And synthetic stimulant could be MSG, and the substances go in our food. Right, Manny?
Right.
That's absolutely what it is. So then they discovered that there's bath salts that they have on it. Please do not use this as a snuff, not for human consumption. Ivory Wave and Vanilla Sky, little packets of powder. And they, Drug Enforcement, DEA, came in and discovered that people were using this, unlike cocaine or meth. It was a stimulant. It was legal in the United States. It sells for $25 to $40 a packet. People are buying it online. They're buying it at convenience stores. They're sniffing it and to try to get high. Now, I didn't realize it was a problem at all. 235 calls at the Poison Control Center for bath salts last year. Just since January, it was 214 cases of people who were sniffing this that were complaining they were. And the problem is that it causes schizophrenia. So people get really, really high, and then they go off the reservation. They just go mentally ill. And it's a drug called MDPV, And it's now being hopefully banned, but it's going to be another 120 days in some states. It has a long duration of 2 to 3.5 hours. Coming down takes 30 to 60 minutes if they sniff it, but it can have after effects of 2 to 48 hours. So people can hallucinate up to 48 hours. I mean, that's a big deal for bath salts. I mean, who would have thought bath salts? Who's going to take and buy bath salts and shove it up their nose? I just find this so bizarre.
So who thought of it?
I mean,
it's clearly the ultimate bubble bath.
Well, you know, and again, Simon, you know, exactly, Simon. And, Simon, it gets back to what we talk about on the other products. So we go GMOs banned here, soy GMOs banned there, all over the United Kingdom, all over Japan. And then I look at the bath salts. United Kingdom, Ireland, and other countries have already banned the drug as a drug. Now, what took this country so long? People have commit suicide with this. They get higher than a kite and then kill themselves.
And actually, the bath salts are, if you will, the next generation. The previous generation was marketed as incense. In fact, I saw it in a convenience store here in Mississippi. Yeah, $20 for this little baggie of, quote, incense, you know, that says, you know, not to be inhaled, but legal.
Oh, my gosh, that's incredible.
Well, they certainly weren't looking for the adult market, were they?
Oh, no.
Yeah, good luck with that war on drugs there.
And to find the discovery for me, which was amazing when reading these reports, was bath salts can be addictive.
Yeah,
I mean, addictive. It's because it has this weird thing in it called MDPV. I mean, it's just, how bizarre. Let me take a bath because I'm addicted. <You know? laughs>
I'm coming down. I feel a bath coming on.
Yeah, really.
I'm going to go sit on the back porch and have a bath.
Yeah, really.
So I guess for young dating couples, taking a bath together needs something different now.
I also have an image of the DEA coming, knocking on your door and breaking into your house to come steal your bath salts. You know what I'm saying? It's like
yeah,
a whole... whole bizarre mental movie that goes on when I read this whole thing.
We have a search warrant for your bathroom.
Yeah, really? You know, I'm coming over to collect your... I heard you bought Ivory Wave and Vanilla Sky. Where is it, you know?
I guess reach for the sky now is a different meaning, too.
Who would have thought? My bath salts.
Yeah, I just can't get over the ways that human beings find... to abuse their body and get high. So, you know, that's both serious and sad. So we're going to approach another serious and sad subject, but this one has a lot more story to it. Ash and I find it interesting that two states, Minnesota and Iowa, have been having trouble with tax credits for motion pictures. And we live in an area where it's really a big deal, where a lot of our friends in the industry just constantly complain about the amount of what we call runaway productions in California. And a runaway production is somebody who goes on location somewhere else and basically spends their money somewhere other than Southern California. Well, you know, it's not considered a very nice thing to do. But it's hard not to, because all these various states wanted to jump into the mix and get this business. Part of it was ego. Part of it is they go on to say, look, there's South Carolina or somewhere else like that on the tube, and that's our state, and we're on television. So, but the price of doing that was giving tax breaks to individual film companies, but it was not necessarily the big film companies. It was the little ones, the low-budget productions. And Ash and I watched a lot of these people forever. And I wouldn't trust someone, a low-budget filmmaker, with my money for anything. And to give him a tax break from a state and then not supervise or watch where the money goes is crazy. So they started indicting people for this abuse. Well, what did they expect? You give someone that kind of money, and they go out and they buy a Range Rover, is what happened in one case, and a variety of other personal items. You go, great, it's time to get fattened up. So in both Iowa and Minnesota, they started indicting film companies. And so Ashley and I thought it would be fun to tell people a little bit about what goes on with that. Early in my career in the 70s, I helped put together a variety of films from Blackula to Blood Black and White, Adios Amigo, and a number of different things involving Dimension Pictures, which is not the current Dimension Pictures. So I was on the set an awful lot, and I can't begin to tell you the insanity that goes on a low-budget set. For one thing, the food they eat, and you can't imagine being on a set where they serve something like Pollo Loco every day, 5 days in a row, three meals a day. And we have one friend who the smell of Pollo Loco right now makes him deathly ill because he had to eat it every day at the set. And this is typical of what goes on in these productions. So, Ashley, you have any stories you want to tell us?
I was thinking about peanut butter and jelly sandwiches is actually what I was thinking about. I think that was one set. You'd get they wouldn't even fix the sandwich. They would actually put the Wonder Bread out with a jar of peanut butter, a jar of jelly, and go for it. That's your lunch. It's like, although I guess we were talking earlier about Churubusco Studio down in Mexico, which was, you know, I think that was, you know, very professional set, and except for how crazy it became down there because they gave this producer a permission to do little explosions, and the next thing they know, there was a very old set there that was from Conan the Barbarian, and after he finished, there was no longer a set for Conan the Barbarian, so there was no history left. You know, and it was a lot of fun, and it was supposed to be a karate film, and it turned out the person who knew all this karate couldn't do karate, so we ended up using guns, you know, fake guns, but the food down there was great, but the promises made by the producer and the actual end product were two completely different things, so trusting somebody with your money without control is insane.
And by the way, this is not only with that. We've seen instances I have in my career where, you know, people made movies for X amount of money, but they really made them for half the amount of money, and the producers didn't realize it until long afterwards.
Well, that's the peanut butter and jelly story. And I was thinking of one set. It's like, here you go, here's a jar of peanut butter and jelly. I'm like, what happened to this budget? You know, it just kind of walked out the door, and it wasn't with me. It's only a dumb actor, you know.
Yeah, I'd like to see their line item on their tax return for feeding the crew. I bet it wasn't for peanut butter and jelly.
Oh, I'll betcha.
Oh, yeah. It's and it really is an experience to be on those sets. In fact, I look back, and they were some of the most charming, wonderful times in my career. And believe me, when they made those old 70s movies, the cocaine they snorted was real. And, you know, basically, when they smoked marijuana, it was real. And I remember one of my clients saying to me, you've got to go down and stop this set. And I said, why? He said, there's a line item for a pound of cocaine. So he sent me down there, and I'm not going to name names because of a very famous group of actors, and had to try and talk to them about it's not appropriate for you to order pounds of cocaine and put them on line items. And this was mid-70s before the cocaine problem was what it was today, but it certainly was prevalent on the set. So, yeah, it's a crazy, crazy atmosphere when you look at it.
Yeah, so
but
for somebody...
Manny, I'm sure that...
Did we lose you, Simon?
Uh-oh.
Did we lose Simon?
I think so. That's never a good sign. Oh, well, he'll be back. Yeah, I would think just describe the cocaine as, I don't know, film processing chemicals.
I think it was a powder special effect. But, you know, in the mid-70s, most, you know, marijuana was popular. People really didn't know that much about cocaine. I certainly did. I was surprised at that stage of my career to see what was going on. It was not something I was used to seeing, nor was I used to showing up on the set trying to do something about it. I know the last thing the world you wanted to do was talk to a cocaine addict about his addiction. No one warned me about that either, you know. March, so it was definitely an exciting day. So
we think we lost Simon?
We may have lost the whole show.
Oh, dear.
Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, maybe I ought to go try line three and call Simon and see what happens.
Let me have the... Bring it up for me.
I feel like I'm on coffee talk. I'm just talk amongst yourselves.
I don't know. I think we're off, right? Because he's not there, so... Correct?
They gave us enough warnings while we were waiting for the show to start.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what time is it? I guess they're probably limited to an hour. Is it 1, 2 o'clock?
Yeah, we usually do an hour and a half, I thought.
Yeah, so...
And he usually warns us often about running out of time.
1 second, I'll be right back.
Oh, yeah, the movie industry was always fun. And then once the lawyers and accountants took it over and got into it, it seemed to be much less fun and they're more concerned about the bottom line.
Well, they're making small, low-budget films in Mongolia now. Maybe you could just, they're probably back to the old days, too, and the accountants, I'm sure, aren't quite in the business as much as they are. I don't think there are too many accountants in Mongolia yet. They're too busy working on the mining industry.
I can't imagine, although I think the great classic of Kurosawa's Urdu Uzala was shot in Mongolia, if I recall. But, yeah, you don't see a lot of movies, particularly here, shot in Mongolia.
Now, there was a producer did about three small movies not too long ago. Was it one, Golden, The Crying Camel, I think. Cute little movies, though. And they did a big Genghis Khan reproduction with the Russians about 3 years ago, but the Mongolians weren't too happy with it. They treated Genghis disrespectfully, they said, and that's something you do not want to do in Mongolia. They're real friendly people, but if you get on the wrong side of Genghis Khan in public, you're liable to get beaten up.
Was that the one with Gerard Butler? I think we saw that recently. They're finally showing it on TV, and I laughed because it took all the, and I can see why they're upset, it took all the extreme versions of his life and use it as a basis of their plot, and that's not always a good thing to do. You know?
No. No, you know the top sumo wrestlers now are Mongolian. Well, have been for about 7 or 8 years.
Well, we're still here.
Oh, you're being recorded.
That's all right. I heard you the first time. Oh. We've gone on without Simon. I hope he's braving the huge storm, I believe, in Mississippi and surviving. Of course, surviving in Mississippi for him is interesting. We have a joke about weight and size. He jokes that he's not known for being British, but because he's the thin guy in town, which always makes me laugh.
I was surprised. I lived in Louisiana for a while when I was working on a ship, and I was just imagining someone like Simon being in the backwoods of Mississippi, where they're fairly conservative, and Simon is anything but conservative. I guess it's all worked out well.
Well, yeah, well,
up
of course,
until
he just
today.
Didn't go to the backwoods with anybody. Nor
what's
should
that
he.
Banjo music?
Yeah. Well, I think his love of music carries him a long way, too. But I happen to love Louisiana. It's an absolutely fabulous place to be. It really is. And I think in the long run, Simon's going to be very happy there. One of the places I considered living my life was New Orleans, which I also love. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful place to be. So still haven't heard back from Simon.
No, we have not.
I imagine he's cursing in four languages right now.
But when I call a number, it goes, dials directly in, and you can hear you guys talking.
Well, let's carry on with the show without
All right,
him.
Let's carry on then, okay.
Okay, one of the next things, which I'm sure you'll find fun and interesting, is a story about the police spying on eco-terrorists in Britain. I don't know if you saw that story. A Scotland Yard inspector named Mark Kennedy went underground, let his hair grow, sported a goatee, wore hoops in his ears, got a few cats on his arm, and he went into the Echo movement. I mean, it sounds like he's going underground with a drug dealer, but he wasn't. It was just ecology. And he was spying for Scotland Yard. And for about, I don't know, 6-7 years, he traveled around with all these Echo, what the British call terrorists, who were basically, you know, standing in front of nuclear plants, objecting to nuclear energy, and he'd report back to Scotland Yard. Well, at some point when they went to prosecute some of them for what they considered picketing at Scotland, at a nuclear plant, suddenly he disappeared and wasn't able to testify because it turned out he was having sex with a couple of women, but he was really married other than that.
With two kids,
and that he'd fallen in love with one and wasn't willing to testify.
That was not his wife.
And he went rogue, and now he's living somewhere in the United States in hiding because, needless to say, the British government's not happy with him because they had to dismiss all these lawsuits. So in England, they were having this huge story about this, but the fundamental part of the story was that Britons were now becoming concerned that, guess what, there really wasn't any place for them to hide from the government in a country that's obsessed with its monitoring of people with their court TV, what we call central TV is I think what they call it, the CTV, closed circuit. And now they're doing it to basically every citizen there. So if you have a dissident viewpoint in England, you're now subject to being followed and taped and having undercover people.
And they're talking about the environmental movement. We're talking about people worried about the green movement and not really heavy duty, guns and blazer kind of people. They're, peaceful people trying to take care of the environment.
Okay, bad news, folks. I'm back.
Oh, great, Simon. I was looking all over for you.
Right.
Researched the countryside, high and low.
I called you on the other line. I looked for you. We're talking about the Echo people in England right now and the police situation, where the police were spying on the Echo environmentalist.
Right.
So,
and I would like to point out that because of a technical problem, I'm now a guest on my own show.
Oh, wow.
That means you don't have to pay.
Right. Yeah, Mark, can we pull the plug on him?
But were you invited?
Has this ever happened to you before?
Not quite this way, but technology has this habit of leaping up and hitting you at the worst times.
Oh, yes, it certainly does. I don't think there's anyone in our country that hasn't been bitten at least once by their computer. So back to what we're talking about. We're talking about how the British government now are spying on their citizens, particularly what they claim to be eco-terrorists. And I don't know why you're being a terrorist when you oppose nuclear power. I think a great many Americans oppose nuclear power, and at times so do I. And it's not so much the power that I oppose. It's that whole symptom that you saw in the movie, the China Syndrome, the poorly managed problems of our government who seem to do everything wrong. So when I look at the daily things they do wrong in our society, do I want to trust them with nuclear power? And the answer is no, I don't feel really comfortable, and I don't know if either of you do either.
I certainly don't.
I trust the Navy.
Well, I'd trust the Navy more as long as they aren't involved in the politics of Washington, and the problem with that is exactly that, is sooner or later the politics get them.
Yeah, my mind went to the Marines. I'm like, oh, yeah, I would definitely, Navy, Marines. I would definitely trust certain aspects because there's such a tremendous loyalty there that I can't see them,
Anything that can be politicized is dangerous in our country. The other night, Julian Assange from WikiLeaks was on 60 Minutes. And I thought many of his points were well taken, that we need a free press. And he pointed out that no one in the history of our country has ever been prosecuted for publishing whistleblowing things, and that the New York Times had published a great deal of what he published, and no one was going to prosecute them. And as a constitutional law student, which is required when you're in law school, it wasn't voluntary, believe me, the simple fact is that, Franklin and Adams and all the others cherished this. And Benjamin Franklin was the foremost proponent of a free press and ensured that it went into our Constitution because they had tried to silence him so often and his writings because he irritated the British government. And Americans should remember that Franklin was required to use a variety of aliases, like Silence Dukas, for example, to conceal who he was. And in some of that he did, even when he worked for his brother before he moved to Philadelphia and worked in Boston, because his brother wouldn't print anything like that for fear of its content. So we have a long history of this going on in our country, and for the government now, particularly a government that is trying to do something about events that occurred during the Bush administration, is even more surprising to me. So I wonder, you know, you guys aren't lawyers, so you didn't take an oath to protect the Constitution, so you may have a completely different viewpoint than I do.
Mark, yeah, I'll let you handle it.
Yeah, I'm a U.S. born citizen. Now, that's a good point about the my dad. We discussed the when closed circuit TV cameras started popping up in England. He and I discussed that, and he thought it was a great idea. Particularly the one that would take a picture of your license plate and tax your car as you went into London on a way to cut down on city traffic. He loved that idea, and I was horrified. But, you know, from a technological standpoint, it makes more sense than to stop the car and pay a toll when you can actually take a picture of it. But I just scarcely saw it as an invasion of privacy, and he was all fine and dandy with it.
Well, I don't think that's the more serious one. I think that there are legitimate functions, and there are times I wish we did it more in the United States. And the primary reason why is, of course, it's so cost prohibitive in this country versus what you can do in a smaller country like that. And when people say to me all the time, well, they do it in Europe, I go, yeah, well, Europe, the combined states of Europe are smaller than the United States, so it's a lot easier and cheaper to do things like that there than it is here. And that's one of the big problems, is everything here is takes more. So what they do is they focus on the most important issues, and that's always spying and things that irritate whoever the government is that's in control.
Going back to the CCTV discussion, and it was a couple of years ago, I put together an article about CCTV in the London area, and it has the densest population of cameras to people anywhere in the world. And I found this delightful website that was dedicated to disabling the cameras, and it basically gave you soup to nuts on you know, the best tactics, from spray paint to using laser pointers. Most of these cameras don't really like a good blast in the lens from a laser pointer.
Oh, no, it actually can destroy the lens.
And those are illegal here, too, right? Aren't laser pointers
illegal?
They're here,
but I don't think they are there. You know, California, as you, I don't know if you've read about this in San Diego, but there's been quite a stir in Los Angeles about the use of these red light cameras that are designed to catch people that are going through, yellow lights. And the problem with it is they shorten the time to increase the number of cameras, and at the end of the day, the city makes very little money. Most of the money goes to the manufacturer of the cameras, so a number of cities, and I think it started with Redland, started to ban them because they found out they were just aggravating their citizens and they weren't making enough money in comparison to the aggravation they were getting. But it's still going on.
Oh, in Beverly Hills. Oh, my gosh. It's unbelievable. You'll start to pull through thinking you're in a green light. It will turn yellow in mid street, and within 2 seconds, it's now red. So you almost have to speed through once you see the yellow because you've got a flick of a second before you're going to get a ticket. I go into panic every time I see one in Beverly Hills. I try to avoid them just because they scare me.
Well, the problem also here is that only a few are enforceable. And the reason only a few are enforceable is most of us don't have front license plates. So every time I go through one...
That's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah. Every time I go through one, I think it's about to bite me. I hold my hand over my face so it can't get my face. So So this brings me to a funny story about that. We have a lady friend who got a one in the mail, because what happens is, you know, they don't get you on the site, so they basically send you one in the mail. So in comes this citation in the mail saying that she ran this stop sign, and she said, I didn't do that. I wasn't in Beverly Hills. I could not have done that. So she pled not guilty and showed up at court indignant. So the judge says, "Are you right? It's not you. There's a man, and it's obviously not you." And she goes, "A man." So the judge hands it to the bailiff and says, "Would you show her this photo?" And she shows her the photo and says, "Do you know this man?" She goes, "Oh yeah, that's my husband." So guess what? They mailed her husband a ticket, and he was not very happy about it.
I had a similar thing happen in Phoenix. I was driving a company vehicle, and we received a citation. Run the infamous yellow light, and my boss said, "I'll take care of this." And he went down to, I think it was Scottsdale, and presented himself and the picture and the citation and said, "This isn't me." And they looked at the picture, they looked at him and they said, "No, indeed it's not, but it's your vehicle." And he said, "It's a company vehicle. Who knows how many people drive it?" And they went, "Okay, yep, dismissed," and basically ripped the ticket up. Now, the truth was, the company consisted of three people.
Oh, my gosh.
But, you know, I mean, no one bothered to ask that question.
Wait, did you by any chance catch the article on the fatal hit-and-run accident that happened? Speaking of traffic and things going on out here in L.A.?
Oh, that dropped a guy, yeah.
Did you see that? It was a fatal hit and run in Hawthorne, and it left one man dead. So this Good Samaritan gets out of the car and attempts to help.
No, that's not what happened, Eddie. What happened is someone got hit by a car on a very busy stretch down there. Along comes a second car and runs over the person. So they're not certain whether they were dead before or after the second car. So in the middle of all this, a good Samaritan gets out to help, and a third car coming along doesn't see her in the dark, slams his foot on the brakes, and actually hits her, but doesn't kill her. So now there's a mob, and they're incensed. So what do? This poor guy, who's the last guy on the scene, they rip him out of the car, beat the crap out of him, steal his cell phone. And he finally escapes and calls the police. So they eventually chase down one of the guys who was responsible for stealing his cell phone, because, like all idiots, he made a cell phone call. But can you believe that? You stop as a Good Samaritan and you get hit, and the next thing you know, everybody's going crazy and attacking the next person?
It's really scary out.
Well, you have to understand that you did say Hawthorne.
Yes.
This is true.
And this is an area, Hawthorne, that was so close to being part of South Los Angeles, it was probably just inches over the old borderline there.
I mean, you know, Simon, people really have to be careful with the road rage. I had an incident happen a while back over at the post office where I went to make a left turn at this one little street that you jiggy-joggy around to get into the post office. And the light turned, so, you know, I had just spent time in Beverly Hills, so I stopped and waited because I'm not going to get caught up in that intersection. So I waited, and suddenly this truck behind me lays on the horn and expects me to go. I mean, just expects me to take off while traffic's going. And so I'm waiting and waiting till the light to turn green with this guy laying on the horn. So I make the left turn. And the guy now tries to run me into the other cars. I then make a right turn on the next street, which is going into the post office, and he is now will not let up on the horn, and this guy follows me into the post office, and I'm now shaking. And I thought, oh, the guy left. Well, it turns out he parked his car, came up, and starts banging on my window. I didn't have my cell phone with me. I didn't have any means of getting around anything. And this guy was like, the look on his face was somebody I've seen in a mental ward as a nurse taking care of people. And the guy was just absolutely insane. I pull out of this place. I get home, and I'm shaking. I still shake about it when I think of it. And I think that people are just a little bit nutso right now with the economy and what's going on. And I think it's important to take a cell phone or camera at all times with you because it's really a little dangerous out right now. People are easily inflamed, and it's scary.